We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about what we know about global fish populations. And here we're talking about fish that live in the ocean. As recently as 2006, some scientists, and here we're talking about essentially people who are ocean ecologists, were predicting that if nothing changed, that commercial fishing would essentially destroy the populations of many ocean fish. Now, there were other scientists, and particularly here we're talking about people who deal in fisheries science, who felt that that assessment was far too negative. And then something very interesting happened. Some scientists from both of these disciplines started to talk together and work together and presented a major report, which was the result of that kind of conversation and collaboration, and was published this past summer in Science magazine. And the result is that perhaps things may not be as bad as we thought. That certainly ocean fish do remain vulnerable to overfishing, and they would argue that we need to continue the effort to rebuild and maintain their numbers, but I think they also would argue that it is possible through responsible practices for commercial fishing to continue and to continue in a sustainable way. And that is what we'll be talking about in this hour of Focus 580. And our guest is Ray Hilborn. He is a professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington and specializes in natural resource management and conservation. He currently serves as an advisor to several international fisheries commissions and agencies, as well as teaching graduate and undergraduate courses in conservation and fisheries stock assessment and also risk analysis. And he was one of those who contributed to this paper that was published in Science this past summer. We're pleased that he could spend some time talking with us. And as we do that, questions, of course, are welcome. The thing we ask of callers is that people need to be as brief as they can, and we ask that so we can keep moving through the program, get as many callers in as possible. But certainly your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. So if you're here where we are, use that one. But we do also have a toll-free line, so that's good to anywhere that you can hear us. And if it's a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point, your questions and comments certainly are welcome. Professor Hilborn, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
That's my pleasure.
We appreciate it. As a very general way to start, if I asked, and I'm sure we can talk about this in some detail, but if I'd say, ask it this way, overall, what is your assessment of global fish stocks right now?
Well, it depends very much on where you are. Uh-huh. And that's one of the things that it is just in some sense totally different from place to place in the world. The U.S. the situation is generally pretty good and getting better. Other parts of the world, certainly in the study that we published, we simply don't know. There's a lot of the world where we have very, very little data that tells us what the trends in stocks are. In our study, we found quite good data for essentially North America, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and a few other places. So we can talk with some confidence about those places. We have a much less idea of the actual status of marine ecosystems in other places.
Mm. Well, just to make sure that I am correct in what I said, would it be correct to say that you would say that with responsible fishing practices, and we can talk about what exactly that means, but that it is possible to have a sustainable fishery that is both productive, provides employment for people, provides product to people, And at the same time, does that in a way so that we're not going to irreparably damage the stocks of fish?
Oh, certainly. Certainly that you know, sustainable fishing is possible and is being practiced in a number of places. The U.S. again stands out as one of the better places. But one of the things we highlight in our study is that well-managed sustainable fishing still dramatically changes the ecosystem. And part of the history of the tension in this is that marine ecologists would look at fisheries, and even though they were sustainably managed, they would say, oh, but look at how different this is. You know, most of the large individuals of a species are gone. The species mixture has changed. You know, and they would often then equate that with ecosystem collapse, whereas in many cases these systems had been like that for decades and never been overfished. For instance, Alaska and New Zealand were the two places that we identified as never having had an overfishing problem. But we shouldn't pretend that those ecosystems are the same as they would be if they weren't being fished.
And I suppose that then what that suggests is that in talking about this question of the health of fish stocks, one of the things I suppose you have to do is decide what your baseline is going to be and what you're going to compare it against. And I suppose if, you know, that means, are you going to compare it against as far back as you can go, what you think it was before there was any fishing? Are you going to compare it to where you were in 1800 or 1900 or 1950? I suppose it just all depends on how you want to frame the question.
Well, in general, we do try to compare the stock to what it would be in the absence of fishing on a stock by stock basis. And so, if you look at the major species that are the important, particularly commercial species, the large scale industrial fisheries of the United States and much of the world, which are, you know, where most of the actual tonnage of catch comes from, you know, we do have ways of trying to say, you know, what were those stocks like? And, you know, before fishing or, you know, 100 years ago or depending on how long the fishery's been there. But the key point is that where you see a lot of changes is often in the non-target species. So, you know, one of the things we showed was that if you're sustainably managing the harvest from the important economic species in a system, there still may be often between 30% and 40% of the species that are typically not major commercial targets that will be severely depleted because they're incidentally caught in the fishing process and they're typically much less productive. So classic examples are sharks or very long-lived fish. Now, the main species you're after are being very well managed and sustainably managed, but those species are going to be and have been traditionally very heavily impacted, and I think we ended up estimating that right now about 18% of the species in the ecosystems we looked at have been depleted to this 10% or less number of where they would have been in the absence of fishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, there. Let me just then ask a question about that. Is that something that can be addressed by changing the method of fishing, either how you do it, what kind of equipment you use?
Yes, and both. Well, the first thing is that we basically recommended that you actually fish a little less hard than you would to maximize the yield of the target species. You give up very little yield, but you have quite a bit less ecosystem impacts, that you would reduce that 30 to 40% number to maybe 10%, that only the most unproductive stocks would be in bad shape. And there's also a lot of scope for protecting those species by the three techniques we talk about is one, closed areas. If you identify places that the weak stocks are sort of their core areas, you can close their most important areas and take your catch of the productive stocks from elsewhere. There's a lot of promise right now in gear changes. So historically, there was an issue of turtle bycatch in shrimp trawls. Well, you know, there was the development of what are called turtle excluder devices that basically dramatically reduced the impact of shrimp trawling on turtles. There's been some great progress in eliminating seabird catch by longlining. And currently in New England, there's the haddock population is booming, but the cod population still hasn't rebuilt, and they've developed some kinds of bottom trawls that catch haddock but not cod. So, and then the third way you can solve that problem, what we often call the mixed stock problem, is by providing direct incentives to fishermen. So in some cases, each boat gets a quota on how much of the weak stocks they can catch, and that provides, and they have to stop fishing when they reach their quota of the weak stocks. And surprisingly enough, fishermen are very smart and very solve problems. They figure out how to catch the target species without catching the weak stocks if you give them the right incentives.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ray Hilborn. He is professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. And we're talking here about what we know about the global fishery, the fish stocks around the world, and about the impact of commercial fishing and what sort of things can be done to preserve, to rebuild the global fishery to make sure that it can be fished sustainably. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, you know, one of the things that I think is really interesting here is how it is that scientists from different disciplines who really have a different way of looking at these questions manage to come together and work together, and then they produce produce this paper that I mentioned that was published in Science this past summer. And also, I guess I'm tickled by the fact that public radio played a role in this. At least the story that I have read is that what happened was that the people at NPR asked you to be on with this Canadian scientist, Boris Worm, to talk about this very thing. And what happened was, in the course of your conversation, that each of you thought, well, the other guy, well, it doesn't sound like such a bad guy. and from that was this idea to try and put these two different perspectives together.
Yeah, that's all correct. It sort of came to a head when Boris and a number of other authors published a paper in 2006 that had one of its, actually it turns out to be a very minor part of their paper, mm-hmm. but it was this claim you mentioned that if things didn't change, all commercial stocks would be gone by 2048.
Yeah.
And those of us who you know work in fisheries management said no, that's just obviously silly, that there are some places that are, you know, that the fish are very, stocks are healthy, and they're not going to all be gone. And then I hadn't met Boris before, but you know, he seemed like a reasonable guy, and we started talking about, you know, how to resolve this, and it worked extremely, extremely well.
And that it strikes me, and it may be that collaborations like this do happen in other fields, but it strikes me that this is maybe in science not such a common thing.
Well, I don't know. You know, I've been involved in a number of long-term controversies, one on the role of salmon hatcheries and another on the role of marine protected areas, and we've never quite had a format like this where we specifically said, let's get together, let's use data rather than opinion to moderate our argument, you know, to understand what the issues are. And it worked, yeah. And in fact, I'm trying to apply this same approach to another big issue in fisheries management having to do with who should get the fish, or what we call fish allocation.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me as if we approach more problems in the way that you suggest, that is, let's work with data and not so much with opinion, we might do a better job at dealing with some big problems.
Yeah, I agree.
We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah, actually, you just sort of mentioned this, the marine protected areas. It is sort of a big deal now. People are talking about protected areas or non-fishing areas and marine areas. And I was just wondering if you could talk about that.
Okay. As a little bit of history, that the whole idea of no-take reserves or marine protected areas as a major element of marine ecosystem policy sort of emerged in the 1990s and got to be extremely popular. And there was a long sort of one of the things that led up to this work that Boris and I did together was a series of papers, including the one that he was a primary author on in 2006. And they would almost always end with saying that, look, fisheries management isn't working, stocks are collapsing, we need new approaches, and almost always suggest that marine protected areas are one of these new approaches that needed to be tried. Now, we need to distinguish between what I might call the ultimate marine protected area, which is a no-take reserve, which means you can't do any form of fishing, and the more generic marine protected area that simply excludes many forms of fishing. So right now, about 60% of the U.S. economic zone is technically a marine protected area in the sense that some forms of fishing are restricted, particularly trawl fishing. I think it's over 60% of the U.S. economic zone, but almost all in the Pacific, not a lot in the Atlantic. But we looked at this in our paper, and essentially marine no-take reserves are still extremely rare and are in none of the major fisheries we looked at were they a significant factor. But closed areas, which is really a traditional fisheries management tool to protect spawning fish or juvenile fish, are very common and were important parts of almost every rebuilding plan we looked at. So the two big ones rebuilding U.S. successes have been in New England and in the West Coast, particularly in California. And in both cases, having some very large areas that were closed to some forms of fishing, particularly fishing on the species they were trying to protect, were an important part of that.
Oh, well, very good. Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in Effingham. This is our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for the program, David, and your guest. It reminds me first of gluttony, and my question is, the Japanese fish for a shark species and take only the fins and throw the rest of it back in the ocean. Does your guest know about that?
I mean, probably not a lot more than you do. I know it's called finning, and certainly not just the Japanese. It's been a very common practice. And I don't know if it's actually now considered illegal. I think it's illegal for U.S. fishermen to do it. It's obviously very wasteful, but worse than that, you know, these sharks tend to be extremely unproductive. That is, they have very few offspring, and it's obviously something people shouldn't do. But it highlights one of the big problems in fisheries, which is international fisheries regulation. The high seas are still largely unregulated, with the exception of mostly tuna and billfish, where there are some international organizations that regulate them. But the high seas are a major problem.
Thank you very much.
Right. Well, that was a question that sooner or later I was going to raise, and that is, you know, that nations have their territorial waters and they exercise their influence to the extent that they can on the waters right around where they are. But there is a lot of water that's international, and then that gets to this question, you know, if we decide we want to put certain rules into place and we want to do what we can to maintain and rebuild fish stocks in international waters, how do we approach that?
Well, okay, the traditional approach is through what are called regional fisheries management organizations. So there's a whole series of international treaties that cover these issues, mostly through the United Nations. And particularly for the major fisheries on the high seas, which are largely tuna fisheries, most of the world is now covered by these regional fisheries management organizations. Having said that, they're actually not very effective. They rely on individual countries to enforce their own the regulations, and the record is somewhere between bad and appalling. The classic example is Atlantic bluefin tuna, where the scientists have consistently advised major reductions in the allowable catch. the politicians on the commission then set the allowable catch at about twice of what the scientific advice is, and then the countries fail to enforce it. There's an enormous amount of unreported illegal catch, estimating that the real catch is four times what the science advises. So there's a major problem in high seas governance, and it's the fact, and it's basically because countries, including the U.S., have not been willing to give up their authority to regulate their own fishermen, and there's a whole bunch of mechanisms you could require international observers on all high seas boats. Okay, that would solve most of these problems. But countries have not, and as I say, it's almost every country has been unwilling to give up its own authority to regulate its own fleet.
Yeah, that seems to be a key issue. That is the concept of national sovereignty and government saying, well, we can decide what happens here, not only in our waters, but what our fishermen do, and they're just not about to be told what they can catch and what they can't.
That's right. And you know, I may be a little out of date, but certainly as of a few years ago, the U.S. had not even signed the International Law of the Sea. It certainly didn't sign it for decades after it was because there were issues that I think mostly having to do not with fish as much as with mineral exploration, that the U.S. was not willing to give up its right. So, you know, there's no one who's completely clean on this issue. But in reality, the high seas tuna stocks, with the exception of the really valuable bluefin tuna, are in pretty good shape. They're probably in better shape than the average fish stock in the world. But it's not because of successful management as much as the fact that the economics of high seas fishing just haven't made fishing for most tuna species that profitable, bluefin being the exception, and bluefin are in terrible shape.
Mm-hmm. Well, you, in addition to that, bluefin tuna, are there particular species that are most threatened, or does that, again, do you have to, in answering that question, do you have to say, well, it depends on what area of the ocean you're talking about?
Certainly depends on which area of the ocean. I think there's pretty good evidence that a lot of sharks, because of their low reproductive ability, are particularly in trouble. But again, that would depend on which sharks and where. So it's pretty complicated. In fisheries, it's almost always better not to try to generalize.
We are at our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580, and I'd like to again introduce our guest, Ray Hilborn. He's professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. He specializes in natural resource management and conservation, currently serves as an advisor to several international fisheries commissions and agencies. He also teaches graduate and undergraduate courses in conservation, in fisheries stock assessment, and risk analysis. He's talking with us by telephone. We're talking about the global fishery and its health, and some of the things that you will find in a paper that was published this past summer in Science that he contributed to, a lot of people contributed to the paper, which is trying to get at some of these basic questions. That is, well, what can we say about global fish stocks and the health of fish populations, and how are we doing? How much of a threat is commercial fishing, and are there things that you could do so that you could have commercial fishing but also have the fish? Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Back at the beginning of the program, I asked just as a very general kind of question about what can you say about assessments of global fish stocks. And you said, well, it sort of depends on where you are, that, for example, the United States, things are actually pretty good and getting better, and that there are some places around the world where we have the data so we can actually say something. But then there are other parts of the world that we just don't know. And so that makes me wonder, well, why is it we don't have that data? Is it simply a matter that there's only so many scientists and we just – the effort to collect data from those places – we just don't have it?
No, there's two kinds of problems. One is that particularly in Asia, which is a very important player in world fisheries, the status of fish stocks is considered a state secret.
Mm.
That they may, in fact, and often do, and I would exclude Japan from this, so now we're talking most of the rest of Asia, they may actually have the same kinds of data we have. Certainly, they have a lot of surveys in Asia, but they are not made public in the same way that they are in Europe or North America, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. So a lot of countries just are unwilling to make this information public. The other issue is that most of the world's fisheries, in terms of number of people employed and number of fish caught, but not are actually small scale fisheries, or they're not big industrial fisheries that are easy to manage. So in reality, there's no real effective monitoring of those fisheries. So that'd be true for almost all African fisheries outside of South Africa and Namibia. That they're just, you know, they just there will be local fishermen. There may be small scale industrial fishing from, you know, motorized fishing from ports and things like that. But they're not monitored in the same way, and they're certainly not assessed. There aren't surveys like we have in Europe and North America and things like that. So all we do have in those places is typically the estimates of catch. Now, FAO, the Food and Agricultural Organization of the UN, attempts to estimate the status of stocks around the world through local experts and things. And their estimate is that about 25 to 30% of the world's fish stocks are overexploited, and that number has been reasonably stable since the mid-90s. And that's pretty consistent with what we've seen in the places we looked at. And using catch data, actually, the places we looked on average are worse than average. That there's particularly the North Atlantic has been subject to such intense industrial fishing for so long that if you just use the catch data, you would say that the places we looked at are not better than average, but they're worse than average.
Hmm. A lot of this seems to be driven by consumer demand, and when we on and off over time, when we had these kinds of conversations with people, that's one thing that we tried to talk about and ask this question. Well, if as a consumer, you're interested in doing your bit to contribute to the health of the fish populations, or at least not to contribute to their decline, do the choices that you make, whether you're in a restaurant ordering something to eat, or you're in a supermarket with something in your hand and deciding whether or not I'm going to buy this, how much difference do those kind of choices make?
They're starting to have a significant impact. There's been a movement in the last 10 or 15 years for consumer action. So it ranges from places like the Monterey Bay Aquarium has a card of what, you know, species that it recommends to eat and species it recommends to avoid. There's a very large program called the Marine Stewardship Council. It's a non-governmental organization in the UK that certifies seafood as being sustainably managed, and the sellers, you'll see it if you go to the grocery stores, will have a label that says MSC certified, and some big retailers, particularly in Europe, but now I believe Walmart, have made a commitment to sell only certified seafood in their stores within the next few years, and that will definitely have an impact. You know, in general, the big markets in Asia have not been influenced by this at all. But you know, a very high portion of the fish that we eat in North America and Europe is imported from overseas. A lot of it is not sustainably harvested, and it, you know, as this movement grows, it'll have more influence. I mean, I think everybody, if you buy fish, you should ask where it comes from. And right now, it's just appalling how ignorant restaurants often are about where their fish come from and even what species they are. But it's, you know, we've just got to start being much more specific about what we eat and trying to avoid species that are not well managed.
All right. Another caller here, someone in Champaign. This is on our line 4. Hello.
Good morning. A question about the Grand Banks and cod fishing. It seems to me that several years ago, cod fishing was put off limits, and I wondered if it still is, and if there's been any monitoring as to, is cod coming back? Is it doing some good? I'll listen offline. Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Again, you have to be a little bit careful about when and where. I mean, the Grand Banks actually consists of a couple fish stocks, and in fact, effectively all Canadian cod stocks collapsed to very low abundance in the 1990s. But the one that has gotten almost all the publicity is the so-called Northern cod stock, which was they closed the fishery in 1991, and it for 15 years or so, it just showed no signs of life. I mean, it was knocked down to perhaps as low as 0.1%. You know, it used to be a couple million fish back in the 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, a couple million tons of fish, I'm sorry. But in fact, in the last 4 years, it has actually shown the first hints of rebuilding. It's actually increased about 50% a year. I think the latest estimates are it's back to 100,000 tons from a low of maybe 10,000 tons, and growing quite rapidly and rebuilding the schools that used to form to spawn. So, you know, and this 2 years ago, I would have just said, no, just no sign of life, and actually many people thought that that ecosystem had been so changed by a combination of fishing and environmental changes that maybe cod would never recover. But in the last couple of years, there's signs of hope.
And that's just a result of cutting back on fishing? It was anything other than that?
Yeah, well, that's the major human action. Is they didn't completely eliminate fishing. They still had some surveys and what they call sentinel fisheries, where fishermen got to go out a couple days a year just to see if there were any fish to be had. Mm-hmm. So I was actually in Newfoundland about a month ago, and there you could still buy cod in restaurants, but they really dramatically cut back the exploitation rates, and given time, things changed, and I think there's pretty good evidence that it was that the failure to recover was a combination of the very severe overfishing, no question about that, but also that they encountered some bad environmental conditions at the same time, and something has changed in the last couple of years, so they're starting to rebuild. Now, a couple of the smaller cod stocks in Canada still apparently are not showing any sign of rebuilding, but people tend to think of cod as cod. You know, the largest cod population in the world is in Norway. I think it's 4 million tons, and it's in great shape. It's probably probably underfished in the grand scheme of what is possible. So there's plenty of, you know, there's a lot of cod available to harvest in some places. Iceland's also doing a good job.
And is that, I guess you wonder, well, why is it that one area gets overfished and another not? Is it just that whoever happens to be in the neighborhood, it depends on what sort of resources the commercial fishery right in that area has? And if there are a lot of fishermen, if there are a lot of boats, that's one thing. If it's an area where there are fewer people, maybe, and there are fewer boats, that's just, it's sort of as simple as that?
No, it's actually much simpler. It almost always has to do with how the governments run the fishery. So Norway has been much better. Iceland has been much better. The contrast between the U.S. and Canada is very interesting. The U.S. has a very strict legal framework under the federal Magnuson-Stevens Fisheries Management and Conservation Act, whereas in Canada there is no the legal structure is not the same, and basically every fisheries decision in Canada is political. It's decided by a politician, the Minister of Fisheries for the major fisheries, and so their attempts at rebuilding have in general been much less successful than American attempts at rebuilding, because American attempts at rebuilding are just incredibly legally constrained, for better and for worse, and a lot of American fishermen will not be very happy about it, but it, certainly American fisheries have been much more successful at rebuilding than Eastern Canada.
If you look at a particular area that is a particular geographic area, an area of water, and you're interested in a particular species, how difficult is it, or is it difficult to determine what a sustainable catch would be?
Well, of course, it depends.
I didn't think it would be that hard a question.
Whether you have a long history, you know, if that stock has been fished for a long time, we usually have can figure out, you know, plus or minus 50%. I mean, fisheries management's an inexact science, but you can, you know, if the number, you can, fisheries management is one sense very simple. If the stock's going down, you should decrease how much you catch until it stops going down and starts going up again. Trying to exactly identify what the perfect number is terribly hard to do. But we know that we can. In fact, if you tell me something about the species of the fish, and what usually that's enough to tell you whether it's a long-lived list fish or a short-lived fish, you can get an idea of what fraction of the population you should be harvesting. If it's a long-lived fish, that might be 5% or 5%. If it's a short-lived fish, it might be 15% or 20%. Like cod, you know, 10% or 15% is a very safe number for cod. Just take 10% of what's out there. Then the problem is trying to figure out how many fish are there, and there's a whole bunch of ways you can go out and you can tag fish, you can do surveys. It's very specific, but if it can be done, but it's also expensive, and that's one of the problems. Is it's typically been economically worthwhile to try to manage the major fisheries of the world, but there are hundreds of species out there that are just minor species, maybe not even commercially caught, and if we wanted to try to track all of those, which the current U.S. law says we need to, and if we want to do it with any precision, it's going to cost a lot more money.
Well, you touched on something that, and I hope it's not either too difficult or too mundane a question, but I did indeed have this question. Well, say again, you're talking about a particular area, and you're talking about a particular species. How you go about counting and deciding, you know, making your decision about how much you're taking. Maybe you know something about the life cycle of the fish, but also one of those things I'm sure that you need to know is, well, how many are there right now? It seems that when you're talking about fish, I'm sure any sort of counting exercise with any animal is going to be challenging, but I would think this would have particular kind of challenges.
Oh, yeah. One of my standard slides I give to students in my class is a quote from a British scientist named John Shepherd, and he said, you know, counting fish is just as easy as counting trees, except they're invisible and they move. Now, you know, in reality, for the major commercial fisheries that we have good data on that constitute most of the United States catch, the government conducts surveys. A lot, if they're bottom fish, this just amounts to dragging nets along the bottom on a systematically designed sample, and you get an idea of the trends in abundance, and also you can various ways get ideas of what the absolute abundance is, and that's really how most of the fisheries regulations in the U.S. works. Is you're following this down, and if we, you know, we look at cod in New England, you see it going down and down and down, or cod or haddock, and now as they're starting to rebuild, we see the number of fish caught in these surveys going up and up and up, and then there's a large number of statistical methods for converting those trends into absolute abundance and what the allowable catch should be, but conceptually, you know, if you set a target level of abundance, and you can think about it just as how many fish you want this survey to catch, and if you're below it, you've got to keep cutting back your catches until it starts to go up, and if you're above it, you can increase your catches until it starts to go down. I mean, it's obviously much more complicated than that, but that's how it works for the major commercial species.
Our guest is Ray Hilborn. He is professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at the University of Washington. And we're talking about what we know about the global fish supply and its health and how it can be managed sustainably. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I wanted to come back to fishing. And perhaps have you talk a little bit about some of the things that you address in the paper, technique-wise, things. And you mentioned, for example, a little bit earlier about the idea that maybe what you can do is make sure that what you're doing is you're catching your target fish, that is, you're catching what you want to catch, and not catching a lot of other things that you really don't. What sort of things are you suggesting that people who are doing this fishing can be doing or should be doing differently than they are now or that they have in the past?
Well, fishermen are very capable people at figuring out how to make the most money under the rules we impose upon them. And so as an example, out here on the west coast of the U.S., we impose upon them a set of what they call trip limits. That is, every time they go fishing, they are allowed to bring back a certain number of each species of fish. And what a fisherman would then do is go out and figure out, given that, how is he going to make the most money? And it would turn out that that it was to go for the species that he had the most, the highest trip limit for, that were the most valuable. And if in the process of catching those fish, he would catch some species that where he exceeded his trip limit, then you would throw them overboard. What's called discarding. Okay, and that's, you know, that's how an individual boat operator is going to make the most money. And but what it meant is that these species where the allowable catch was very low, which were usually the ones that were the least productive and the most conservation concerned, were being harvested at a much higher rate than the target quota, because so much of it was being discarded, as thrown overboard.
Yeah.
And the solution to that is to change the system so that they can't throw it overboard. They have to retain it, and they have to stop fishing when they exceed any of their limits. And so the Canadians did that about 95 or so. So what, about 14 years ago, and it's worked extremely well. That the fishermen actually are making as much or more money than they were before. Through a number of reasons, and the catch of these non-target species or the species of conservation concern has been dramatically reduced. But there had to end up being an individual limit on each boat, and those limits actually turned out to be tradable. And the U.S. West Coast has just adopted the same system, but, you know, 15 years after the Canadians showed that it worked.
Let's talk with somebody else here. We have a caller on line number one, someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if your guests could speak about salmon fishing on the in the northeast, northwest, and Alaska. And maybe since that's more strict fishing, maybe that's not something your guest wants to cover. I'll get off the air and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, he probably doesn't want to hear my tales of salmon fishing. I'm a pretty unsuccessful salmon fisherman, although I do actually catch several thousand salmon a year up in Alaska, but with nets and in order to tag them. Probably what would be the most interest to your readers is a quick overview of the status of salmon. And again, here's the good news. There's more salmon in the Pacific Ocean now than any time in recorded history, and probably any time in geological history. The bad news is that not many of these fish come from Washington, Oregon, and California, or from southern British Columbia. They come from Alaska and from Russia dominantly. Both Alaska and Russia have had record levels of salmon in the last 20 and 30 years. In fact, this year I think Russia had its largest salmon catch ever. And they're also not necessarily the species. The desired sports species in Washington, Oregon, California are Chinook salmon and coho salmon and steelhead, and they are not in particularly good shape. But even in Alaska, they're not booming in the same way that pink salmon and chum salmon are. Even in Puget Sound, where I live, this was an unbelievable year for salmon fishing. I mean, every time I went out in in August and September in a boat, I could look out and I could see salmon jumping in the air, and you could go out and catch four or five in a couple hours. Now, unfortunately, these are pink salmon, which aren't nearly as tasty. They aren't as desirable as a sport fishing commodity as the Chinook and coho salmon, which are not in particularly good shape. So again, it's the same picture. You know, you've got to look at where, what species, and then the causes are complicated. And in, for Chinook and Coho, the decline in the lower 48 is clearly both a problem in changing environmental conditions in the ocean, not caused by man, but just natural changes, but a lot of an enormous amount of habitat loss in some places.
Yeah, when we talk about salmon, and certainly we've talked about here in the past, we've noted the fact that, well, you know, we're being told that eating fish like salmon is good for us. So there's this growing market for salmon, and to satisfy that, there's been a real boom in aquaculture, fish farming. But then again, you talk to the ecologists, and they say, well, you know, we're not exactly sure that's such a great idea either, and that they are then suggesting that if people want to have salmon, they have wild, they look for wild-caught salmon. And then that also, to me, you know, leads to some questions about, well, what's the, is that a problem if suddenly we decide we want to have a lot of salmon and wild-caught salmon, you know, what's that mean for the fisheries, particularly in the Pacific, where that I think in the past had been said to be in pretty good shape.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can eat wild caught salmon with no concerns about. I mean, that's definitely the answer. There's an enormous amount of it on the market, mostly from Canada, some from British Columbia. There's not a lot that comes from Washington, Oregon, and California, but you could eat that with good conscience as well, because it's quite well regulated. But essentially, you know, what you would find in the U.S. would be almost always Alaskan salmon. It's one of those stocks that's certified by the Marine Stewardship Council. I think it was one of the second or third major certification. There are certainly a lot of ecological concerns about salmon farming, one of which is that you grow salmon in farms by catching other fish and feeding them to salmon. But it's a very big industry, and I'm not really an expert on aquaculture, so I won't go any farther down
there.
Sure,
okay. Another caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I didn't hear you mention sockeye salmon. Is that not species, or what? What's the story on sockeye salmon?
Sockeye salmon is dominantly from Alaska. It's actually one of the areas of my own personal research. It's in excellent shape in Alaska. You know, you should eat sockeye about five times a week, as far as I'm concerned. And I try to eat it at least once a week. It freezes very well. It's not much of a sport target fish, but you know, the fishery I work in Bristol Bay, we had 40 million sockeye salmon return, and this year Bristol Bay's about over half of the whole world production. It's an amazing fishery. We will often get in the peak of the season several million sockeye a day being caught. And in the U.S., you can get it dominantly either as canned salmon, and I don't know why Americans eat so much canned tuna and don't eat more canned salmon. But you can also now increasingly get it. It's frozen. There's a lot of fillet production, and personally, I don't know. Most of the stores tend to thaw it before they sell it. But what I do is I buy it frozen in the fillet freezer packs. You know, where you have about a pound to 2 pounds of, and you can just pop it in cold water, be thawed in 15 or 20 minutes inside the bag, and it's a great way to eat fish.
Now, is sockeye salmon caught in the bays or oceans, or is it caught in the rivers?
It's almost all caught in the bays just before it enters the river. So but when they enter the river, they start to lose their fat content.
Yeah.
Again, in Alaska, almost all the fisheries are now what we call terminal fisheries, so they know exactly what species they're, I mean, what stock they're catching. And they're caught, you know, in the last 5 to 15 miles before they enter the rivers. And Bristol Bay is the big producer, but Prince William Sound produces some. Kodiak produces a lot. Cook Inlet, Chignik. I just wish that you would buy fish would be sold like wine. You know exactly where it came from, and you see that down in Seattle. You see, this is a Bristol Bay fish. This is a Copper River fish. This is a Cook Inlet fish.
Yeah, I agree. I would really like to see that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Just real quickly, you know, it seems to me that a lot of the reporting on the problems of the commercial fisheries along the coast of the United States and Canada, you invariably get people who are fishermen talking about their concerns for the future and saying something like, you know, I fish, my dad fished, maybe my grandfather fished, but I think I understand now that my sons and my grandsons, they're not going to. Is there something to the idea that the global fishery just is going to have to contract? That is, it's not going to be able to employ as many people?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you know, I would say that the future of the fishing industry, from the point of view of fish being able to be caught, is quite good. And you know, even in places like New England, the total revenue from fishing has, in fact, continued to increase. But what's killing fishing industry, the fishing fishermen, and particularly fishing communities, is a combination of increasing costs and increasing competitiveness. So, you know, there's no question that the number of people employed in fishing is going to go down. It's going to have to become much more efficient just to compete. And you know, by efficient, I mean it probably means various ways of keeping the cost down. And again, going back to my favorite example up in Alaskan salmon, in 1989, one of these sockeye salmon I was just talking about that a fisherman would sell was the cost the same as a barrel of oil. So every fish was a barrel of oil, and now every fish is a Big Mac.
Wow.
And that's just and that's basically global competition. The price of salmon has gone from, you know, from $2 a pound down to, depending on where you are, 50 to 50 cents. It's going, they're working more on quality, getting more like a dollar, but it's a very competitive business. And it's a tough business, but you know, certainly in places that are well managed like the U.S., the future of the fish supply itself is not, to me, a major concern.
All right, our guest is Ray Hilborn. He's professor in the School of Aquatic and Fishery Sciences at University of Washington. Professor Hilborn, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.